All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with verses 18 through 20 of chapter 3. I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are nothing more than beasts. For what happens to the sons of men and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for the man over the beast. For all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust. And we were down to point 9 here. The infinitive of barer here has caused some significant discussion in that it is often used in the sense of purging or purifying something or someone. And I did have the right verse there, 2 Samuel 22:27. The you show yourself pure is the verb form of barer there. So we might say with the one being purified, you continue to act in a purifying manner, would be a loose translation of it. And with the perverted, you show yourself astute there at the end of verse 27. And literally the word there is twisted. With the twisted, you show yourself twisted. So also Isaiah 52:11. That's one of the things about the nature of God that, again, the fundies don't particularly care for, is that there are these verses that portray God as being downright cruel sometimes, or certainly giving men what they deserve, or acting in response to them in a similar fashion that the fundies would think was, well, this is beneath God to act this way. No, it's absolutely not. Again, Jesus rejoiced one time in the Spirit and said, you know, you've managed to reveal all these things, the truths of doctrine to babes, but you keep them hidden from those that are negative. And there's a sense, and that's why he taught in parables, of course, was so that the people who weren't with it, the people who weren't intellectually honest, wouldn't get it, and the people who were would. And so the reality is, I mean, Jesus, any communicator, could get up and teach on any given occasion, and some people will get it, some people won't. Well, what's the difference? Well, the difference is in their volitional pattern, their volitional response. Obviously, the teaching can only be the same if it's coming out, you know, from one source. Jesus only taught one thing, we might say. So Isaiah 52:11 here, depart, go out from there, touch nothing unclean, go out of the midst of her, purify yourselves. And that is the way the word is most often used, is purifying. 10, however, the root idea of the infinitive is that of separating, sifting, or sorting. Elohim is the subject, and the sons of men are the objects. And so, as they've translated here, again, they made an interpretative translation, and recognized that the idea here is testing something to find out what it is, and then to make the distinction as you see the distinction. 11, while God is delaying his righteous judgment of the human race, men are developing and manifesting their true character, which allows the distinction between good and bad to become evident. And when I say developing, men are in a process. Men are in a state of flux, we might say. They are making decisions that are ultimately going to affect their future. And if they're bad decisions, ultimately they're going to affect their future adversely. But as they make regular decisions over and over again, it begins to form a part of their character. And their character, you know, if a person lies continually, they just lie, eventually their character is going to become that of a liar. If a person's just critical continually, just criticizing one thing after another over and over and over again, that's all they're going to become is a critic. They won't. This will what their character will end up being. And so the person is just arrogant on repeated circumstances, repeated occasions. Eventually, that's going to manifest itself in their character, this arrogance. And then, of course, then it becomes second nature. So again, here they are developing and manifesting their true character. And then ultimately, at the end of it all, you'll see what they are, which allows the distinction between good and bad to become evident. 12, while the subordinate clause does not contain a finite verb, the infinitive here does have a discrete subject and object. So what you actually have here is Elohim to test sons of men. And so they've translated it like it's a finite verb, has surely tested them. And I don't think it does any injustice to what you have in the text here, because you do actually have a subject, a verbal form, and an object. So that is, in my opinion, at least a nominal sentence. So 13, the final portion of verse 18 should be understood as a purpose clause and explains why Elohim allows unrighteousness and injustice in this present world. 14, one purpose of allowing man's inhumanity to man is to demonstrate the depraved nature that often dominates the human race. And where better to see this than when you see men oppressing other men? If you've watched some of those movies, and some of them are hard to watch, I recognize, but or are familiar with some of the historical truths behind them. For instance, the slaughter there, you know, the many slaughters, of course, have occurred there. But in South Africa, when you had the, you know, the Hutus and the Tutsis killing each other. And substantially, there's not really that much difference between them. But yet, the reality is, they see these subtle differences and kill each other. And so these slaughters go on all the time. And if you, yeah, those movies are hard to watch, but they definitely show man's inhumanity to man. And it goes on all over the world. People brutalize people. It happens all the time. And when you look at the human race against that backdrop of injustice and oppression, it's not a pretty picture. It's really not. And for men to wander around with this, you know, men are basically good and, you know, just trust men because their character's fine. No. There's nothing in history that would document that. And in fact, any careful study of history would blow that theory completely out of the way. These people have to put on blinders to make these kinds of assertions. That all of it, when you go and look at the subject, let's say, of the Holocaust and these types of things, you look at the nature of warfare and the things men have done to other men. And, you know, driven by what? Many times fear, greed, power. What was the motivation behind it all? Well, the idea here is that these situations come to pass, they become evident, and it shows what man's nature really is. And man's nature isn't good. And again, this reaches right back immediately. Was man created this way, or is this a result of the fall? Did man's nature become altered in such a way that we now have this situation that exists that Solomon sees, that we all see? 15, Koheleth does not state that men are like animals in some ways. He strongly asserts that they are, in fact, animals. And you watch, again, as you observe life, and you know, it's shown all around if you just observe it. It's in our programming. It's everywhere. People are prone to take advantage of one another. They're prone to oppress one another. They're prone to do this or that. And guess what? It's not appropriate, but the reality is that's the way it is. So men don't live up to, quote, the high standards that people say they do. I'm not saying that there's never a time when a man hasn't made an extreme sacrifice or done something, but that is the exception in human history, not the rule. That is not the rule. That's the exception. 16, the purpose is for mankind to see for themselves. That is the sense of the final phrase, hem alahem, they for them, that humanity is often no better than the animal world. 1 Kings 14:23, where it uses that very same construction. And they translated it here the very same way, so they can see. Well, they didn't actually put it in the New American Standard of Ecclesiastes, but they did here. They built they for them. Literally in verse 23, they built for themselves high places. And that's what you have here, is God wants man to see it for themselves. Just forget, as we might say, forget God's assessment of it for the moment. Is there enough evidence here for mankind to see that mankind is brutal? And that this is the nature of the human race? That in many ways, it is out there in the jungle. It is the law of the jungle. Welcome to the jungle. We got what you need. And it's, what is it? Survival of the fittest, right? And that's what it is. That's what and typically, that's what it has always been taught sort of in the job world out there. You climb to the top. If you have to step on somebody to get there, that's fine. It's survival of the fittest. The cream will always rise to the top. And just do what you need to do. And look out for nobody but number one. You'll be fine. That's been the, if not unspoken, that's been the spoken mentality in many occasions. That this is what it's all about. Don't worry about the, you know, if somebody has a good idea, take credit for it. Don't attribute it to them. Use every means, fair or foul, to get ahead. I'm just talking in the corporate realm. And then, of course, this translates into, interpersonal relationships and how people deal with one another. And then on a national level into warfare and all of this kind of stuff. Crush the enemy. And how does this all start? Well, generally with a smear campaign, you got to win over popular sentiment for your war. So everybody's happy with it. How do we need to have a war? Why? Well, war's big bucks. And the fact is, in my opinion, most of the wars today are only about money anymore. They're not about ideologies. Our government never thought Hussein had weapons of mass destruction over there. And if he did, we know who sold them to him. We knew exactly what he had because we armed him. Just as we supported and armed the Shah of Iran until we didn't need him anymore. Just as we supported many of these people and all of this, If I remember right, Ho Chi Minh worked for the American government at one time. And so, we set them up, we bring them down. And this all gets into, that's a pretty brutalized way of dealing with life, don't you think? I mean, we'll take entire cultures and civilizations down at our whim. And at the bottom line of all of it, if it isn't money, I'm interested to know what it is. Because as most people will tell you in life, if you want to know what's going on, follow the money. And you'll figure it out. So the purpose, again, is so mankind can see this for themselves. God is, in a sense, we might say, under the permissive will, allowing this, so that man will recognize exactly what it is in terms of its character. 17, the animal world is run by the principles of self-preservation and survival of the fittest. In a similar way, men operate with greed and cunning in order to get what they want. 18, oppression and injustice are simply evidences that man does not give much thought to the morality of his actions. And this has been replayed. I mean, you can see this in almost everywhere. Do people really care if what they do is unjust, immoral, oppressive, wrong? If it advances their cause, do they really care? And the answer is largely, history would say no, they don't. They will do exactly what they want to do. And so we don't look at animals and say, they're thinking about the heavy, weightier moral issues of life. They're thinking about where their next meal comes from. They're thinking about, I'm hungry. They're thinking about, I need to protect myself. You got basic survival instincts in animals. I got to eat and I got to stay alive. And in many cases, men aren't any better than that. And yet, and you look at it, and what do they get for their life out of all of that? That becomes their whole life, eating and staying alive. And not getting killed, self-preservation. Well, 19, while all this is true, the primary reason Koheleth advances is that the sons of men are no better than animals, relates to the fact that both are mortal. 20, the subject of death has not been far from Koheleth's mind at any point. He now returns to the fact that death is inevitable in both cases. And again, I think, as he has given pause now, at some point later in his life, and said, wait a second, I'm going to die, and I'm not at all ready for this necessarily. And I think this is weighing very heavily on him. A clean conscience is worth a lot. I mean, if you're going to have to die, and again, although we live in the rapture generation, there's no guarantee we won't die before the rapture. None of us have that, and I haven't got some twitch from God to say, you're going to live and don't worry about it. I mean, I've always believed I would be raptured, but you know what? I could die before the rapture. If my course is completed before the rapture, then it's completed. And believe me, I don't want to stay 1 minute longer than I need to. So the idea here is death weighs on people. And when they face their mortality, this starts to heavily weigh upon them. And particularly if you get up to this and your conscience is guilty because you didn't do it right and you know you didn't do it right. That is, to me, not anything I ever want to deal with. Death will be challenging enough as it is. But to have to get to it with a guilty conscience, nah. I've committed my share of failures and sins and all of that, but fortunately, rebound and grace take care of all that. But did I do it right as far as the ministry and all that? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've got a clear conscience on that one. So death is inevitable. You're not going to get around it. 21, Koheleth introduces the cause for his assertion with the conjunction key, for or because, at the beginning of verse 19. And 22, the Hebrew term mikra, which is translated as fate, is not to be understood as some impersonal, mysterious power that is beyond God's control. 23, it has a far more neutral connotation and denotes that which happens or occurs to an individual over which there is no control. And I understand why they translated it by fate, but again, it just means a chance occurrence, a happenstance, what comes to pass. And again, it's not some mysterious power that brings it to pass, we might say, as much as that it just happens and you don't have any control over it. 24, one cannot determine the manner and timing of death. However, one can be assured that even though death may be unpredictable, it is certain. And again, I don't know about you, but I just soon go to sleep at night and not wake up. Wake up in heaven. Okay. That'd be easy enough. I could do that. But you never know. I mean, it could be a fiery car wreck. Could be a drive-by shooting. Or a run-by fruiting. You never know. It's hard to tell. So again, even though it's unpredictable, the fact is, again, given absent further revelation, the rapture, we're all going to die. This is very upbeat this morning, isn't it? We're all going to die. Whoopee! So 25, Koheleth is relatively terse in the first portion of the verse. And he concludes it with the summary statement, even one fate for them. The 26, he asserts that just as men die, so do animals. The inescapable fact makes it plain to him that humans have no real advantage over animals. Now, only from this one perspective is this true, right? I mean, aren't there other advantages humans have over animals, like credit cards? There's other advantages, but he's not focusing on that. He's not focusing on, you know, all the things that you do actually get that are way beyond what animals get. He's focusing on the one thing he wants to focus on, and that is, can you argue with this, that animals die and men die? And the answer is no, you can't argue with that. So he asserts that just as men die, so do animals. This makes it plain that humans have no real advantage over the animals. At the end of the day, we might say, at the end of it all, what's going to happen? You're going to die and your dog's going to die. And that's it. And probably your dog will die before you do because they live in dog years. But the reality is you'll face death. It's a reality that you can't get around. And again, I think this all screams to me the results of the fall. Why this preoccupation with death? Because this is what came out of the fall. 27, he goes on to assert that what is he observed is that one force seems to animate both men and animals, the breath. When the breath stops, the life stops. And just from a purely, arbitrary standpoint, if, you fall out of your chair and stop breathing, we're going to figure you're dead. Now, people know CPR, they might try to resuscitate you or whatever. Or they might say, I don't know. let me think about it. I want to pray about this one more. But the point is, same with animals. When their breathing stops, we consider them to be dead. Say, well, there might be some brain activity. Well, it won't last long without breath, trust me. Whatever the brain activity is going on, after that last breath, it won't last long. The brain will become oxygen deprived and it'll die quickly. It won't take very long either. And strictly, again, from a purely physical standpoint, when you observe this, if you observe a man laying there without breathing and an animal laying there without breathing, you will conclude they're both dead. And people and scientists can argue about all kinds of things, But if you can't breathe on your own, you're probably dead. And if you're not dead, you'll be dead shortly. So, again, do doctors play God in all of this and keep people alive beyond their time? I don't know. I'm not even going to waste my time with that. But sometimes maybe they do. I don't know. But the reality is, if you can't breathe, you're probably dead. And maybe that was what, if God isn't giving you the breath of life, then maybe he pulled the plug. But that's God's call, again. So 28, from a purely physical standpoint, it would seem there is no difference between men and animals, since one cannot see the soul or human spirit. 29, however, did Koheleth truly believe there was no difference between men and animals? Now this begs the question, did he really believe this, or is he just making this assertion to prove one particular point? Or is he merely using the similarity to prove his point that man does not have any advantages over animals, since they both die? Because he reiterates this in 12:7. Well, I take it back. He doesn't reiterate this. When he talks about the human experience of death, he describes it in far more poetic terms than he describes animals' deaths. And in verse 7, he says, "Then the dust will return as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it." So does this mean, would you take this verse to mean that Solomon understood a distinction between men and animals? And that there was a physiological distinction here, a spiritual distinction to be made, that men are different in some regard? And I think Solomon was a smart enough guy. Yes, he knew this. That's my take on it. I think he knew this. But again, why does he want to present it this way? He's challenging his audience to think outside the box, as it were. Okay, well, if we all die, then, okay, what's the next logical corollary to this? Well, then let's just do what the animals do. Let's just copulate and eat and move on. Wouldn't that be the next logical corollary? Let's stay alive, eat, copulate, and move on. Because that's all animals do, isn't it? I mean, the animals aren't planning for retirement. Animals aren't buying cars. They don't have charge accounts. So let's live like animals. Wouldn't that be the logical corollary to this statement? Then there's no point. So if we're no better than animals, why? What's the point? And Solomon would argue, looking at the injustice and oppression I've seen out there, we aren't any better than the animals. And at some point, there's a truth to this statement. Unfortunately, it is true. Well, 30 here, the use of the term ruach, wind, breath, or spirit, would seem to demand breath as the translation, since he is making a point that men and animals seem to have the same animating principle within them. From a purely physical observation, the way you can tell somebody is alive, the way you can tell an animal is alive, is it's breathing. You can't tell any other way from a strictly physical perspective. I mean, I guess you could take a pulse, you can feel that, see if the heart's beating and all that. But it's tough to take a pulse on a mouse to see if it's alive. But you can see if it's breathing. That's pretty readily, you can tell that real quick. Just looking at any animal of any size, you can see if it's breathing or not. And if it is breathing, well, you conclude it's alive, I think. If it's not, you conclude it's dead. So, bluntly here, 31, he bluntly states that man does not seem to have any edge on the animal kingdom. And then explains his reasoning, they are both transient. They both come and they both go. They both live and they both die. They're both made out of dust and they're both going to return to dust. And the bottom line is, unfortunately, you can't argue with this. This is all true. This is all true. But now, the one thing I did notice about all of this is he's going to use this as we get a little further into this chapter here, towards the end of it. And then he makes an assertion, all go to the same place. All came from dust and all return to dust. Can you argue with that? No, we can't. That comes right out of Genesis. And now here, experientially, who can prove, who knows, that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? Can you prove this to me beyond question? That there is a different animating principle for men than for animals? And from purely human observation, no, you cannot. No, you can't. That only comes from divine revelation, does it not? So once again, the argument here seems to me is that all this knowledge that we have about the human spirit, the soul, the fact that we aren't animals, comes from revelation, right? And it's the only way we know this is by faith. We don't know it from experiential observation. We only know this by faith. And so this would challenge his audience. What do I believe? Do I really believe that we're no better than the animals? Is that it? Is this really what I believe? Simply because we both die? Again, simply because we both die, is it a logical conclusion to conclude that we're no better? I don't think that's the next logical corollary. But it certainly is a true principle. So both are transient. 32, the term hevel, which is again vanity, is one of the term that dominates this book, in fact, which has usually been translated as vanity, also contains the nuance of that which is fleeting, transient, or temporary. And I think in this context here of dealing with this idea of they all go to the same place. It's the end of verse 19. What advantage is there for the man over the beast? For all are temporal. I think temporal here is the idea he's getting at. All are transient. It's not, he's saying, that they're all useless, but maybe in some sense they are. But I think he's getting at the fact that death puts an end to all this. It puts the end to it for men, and it puts the end to it for animals. And so I think the idea here is that the idea of the transitory nature of things, the temporary, fleeting nature of things, is more to the forefront in this particular usage of the word. That this is all transient. 33, since men and animals are going to pass from the earthly scene, his conclusion is that man is no better off than cattle. There's no advantage. Now, would you rather be a cattle or a man? If there's really no advantage, you know. But is there an advantage to being a cattle or a man? Well, the man's higher on the food chain, I'll give you that one. You know, there is one advantage I can think of. I get to eat cattle, they don't eat me. Well, that's a kind of an advantage. But again, he's not focusing on all of that, and is man really better? What he is saying is that from a human perspective, you can't prove any different. To 34, he continues to document his claim that animals and men are all going to the same place, which he does not closely identify. However, it is clear that the place in view is the earth, which eventually becomes the graveyard into which all the dead return. 35, this is strongly reminiscent of the Genesis account of creation, coupled with, again, the Genesis account of the fall, that I think this permeates his thinking and all of that. Genesis 2:7 was the verse where we see the formation of the body of man. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground. Now my contention has always been that he formed him and there was Adam. There was this perfectly, well, I say Adam, but he wasn't Adam yet. There was this inanimate body laying there on the ground, perfectly formed in every way. Had a set of lungs, set of eyes, brain, heart, all the things you need for life. Liver, kidneys, all the stuff. Feet, hands, eyes, ears, the whole nine yards. Full head of hair. That bugs me the most. And full head of hair. And yet, is he alive? No. Not until God breathes into his nostrils the breath of life. And he's perfectly formed in every regard, but he's not alive. As he lays there, we might say. Until then, he says here, God breathed into his nostrils. And I would translate the and here as a then, and temporal in sequence of events. He creates the body first. And that pattern is still seen today. The body is created in the womb of the woman. The physical body is created. But is the baby alive in there with its own soul? No. No, it's... starts out as just like a one-celled organism. Where are you going to put the soul? No. But the second that baby's born, if it indeed is born, and we talk about being born, what does that mean to be born? It means you come into existence. Your life starts. And so when the baby comes out, boom, the breath of life in the nostrils, wah, there you go. Very happy to be here. Thank you. So the idea is that they become alive at that point. Again, I wouldn't argue people theologically a whole long time over abortion and all the issues related to that. But the pattern established in Genesis still seems to be the pattern that's used today. That God forms the physical first and then imputes life to it when he's ready to. Genesis also 3:19 here. This was the fall now. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground. Because from it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return. And certainly this deals only with the physical body of man. The soul, we would say, is immaterial, invisible. It wasn't made out of dust. The soul is completely something separate. And God doesn't address that at the fall, does he? He just talks about the body. Here's what's going to happen to you. You're going to die, and that's it. Psalm 103:14 also. So right out of the fall comes this principle of death. And actually, the death occurred at the fall, but it was spiritual death. Physical death didn't occur for Adam until some 930 years later. But he died spiritually that day. Psalm 103:14. For he himself knows our frame. And this is a good thing. I have to comfort myself with this from time to time. Because you can get down on yourself and you can think, oh, I fail, I'm this, I'm that, blah, blah, blah. I don't live up to God's standards like I should all the time. Well, nobody does. And further, God has compassion on us and he recognizes, you know, that we're way inferior to him. And he knows our frame and he is mindful of the fact that we are but dust. As for man, his days are like grass. As the flower of the field, so he flourishes. And when the wind has passed over it, it is no more. And so you come and you go. You live through this life. God gave you a soul, gave you life, and you get to live it. You get free will in all of this. You get to choose. And I say, as Solomon says, enjoy it as much as you can. Can you imagine going through life denying yourself everything? You know, these people that are, you know, these religious hermits and nuts that go off and they deny themselves everything. Separate themselves from society. No pleasure. I'm not going to allow any pleasure. Some of them, you know, they won't even talk. Take vows of silence. No fellowship. No, you know. Eat very austere food. Live in very austere environments. And pass. Not interested. Solomon didn't do all that. And again, we should always recognize, okay, well, behind all this, there's God's judgments. God's going to judge me for how I live this life. But he gives me eternal life as well, and then he's going to judge me for how I use that. There's going to be a judgment of how I handled my spiritual life. It's called the Bema Seat. And what I did with it. So at a certain level, you know, this whole idea of seize the day, enjoy it. And plus, who knows, you may be dead tomorrow. Well, I'm going to deny myself everything today, and then I'll live it up tomorrow. Well, what if tomorrow never comes? Then it may not. So again, you have to factor. I think, you know, studying books like this gives you a perspective that we don't get sometimes in some of the other literature of the Bible. And this is, again, a pretty wise guy talking. This is a pretty smart fellow who's got, I believe, a fair amount of doctrine. And he's figured certain things out. One of the things he did figure out, of course, was that arbitrary self-indulgence doesn't make you happy either. Now, he would also, I think, if you could interview Solomon, he would tell you, on the one hand, enjoy yourself. On the other hand, if you make self-enjoyment and pleasure the sole goal in life, you're going to find out that you're not happy. There has to be a balance to life. I think he does a brilliant job through here so far of the parts I've studied. He mentions God enough to keep you cognizant of the fact that God's in charge of all this. But he's not preachy about it, saying, you know, God's going to lower the boom on you. Every other verse isn't a verse of judgment or this or that. But it does present a very well-balanced, that may be a little depressing, view of the human race and of life. Ecclesiastes 12:7, well, then the dust will return to the earth as it was. We just read that one. And the spirit will return to God who gave it. So God gave the spirit. God gave, you know, the spirit in this context, I believe, refers to your soul. I don't think he's dealing with a bunch of biblical anthropology at this point as much as he's just acknowledging there is a spiritual component to life. He doesn't say this about the animals. He doesn't say the animal's spirit returns. He in fact argues from the physical, you can't prove it. But what does he himself believe? If you read carefully, I think you'll find he believes something different than what he said, per se. 36, although the physical body does return to the constituent elements from which it was made, Koheleth says nothing of what happens to the soul, since it is not germane to his argument. And in that regard, he's really good at staying focused on what he wants to say and doesn't get distracted by the peripheral that he doesn't want to deal with at this point. 37, further, he ignores the obvious divine revelation that mankind is superior to the animals and has been given dominion over them. He doesn't mention Genesis 1:28, although he would have had to be familiar with it. Anyone could cite, and maybe that's what he wanted his audience to do. Hey, what about this verse? Ah, now you're thinking for yourself. There you go. What about this verse? God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So is man superior to the animals? Well, from an authority perspective, certainly he is. Now, are they both going to die? Sure. But that's not, again, that ignores this fact, at least. Psalm 8, 6 through 8, which Solomon would have had, I believe, as a part of his repertoire, because this was written by David. And I think he would have been familiar with his father's writings. When he talks about man, and he mentions man as only being a little lower than God. Well, quite a little lower, but still, for the sake of the argument, man is lower than God in verse 5. You have made him a little lower than God, yet you crown him with glory and majesty. You make him to rule over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. Again, the idea here would be under his authority. All the sheep, oxen, beasts of the field, so is man superior to the animals? Well, yes, at this level, of course he is. And man still has authority over all the animals. Last time I checked, I haven't seen this rescinded. And as we know, the righteous man cares for his beast and takes care of him and all that. So, but if the unrighteous man wants to kill his beast, that's his business, isn't it? Because he's got the authority to do so. And so, again, he ignores this part of the divine revelation, but it's not germane to the point he's making. And, oh, good, my windows are down. Time out. It's time. Seems cooler in here now. An idiot. Okay. Now, if I can get back into fellowship, it's just a fact of life. It's one of those things you made your own stupid decision, didn't you? Okay. Let's continue on here then. We'll wrap this up. We only got about 10 minutes anyway, so I'll stretch this out. 38 is where we stopped here. We read nothing more of the fact that only man is declared to be created in the image of God. Further, there is no biblical evidence that God breathed life into animals as he did to men. The Genesis passage there indicates that, and again, that would only be at the very best, if you were going to argue the point that God created animals in his own image, it would have to be an argument from silence, because the Bible doesn't say that. But we do have a distinct verse that says God created men in his own image. Men and women, in fact. In fact, to create fully in his image, he had to create two sexes, two souls of different sexes, a male soul and a female soul. And God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, etc., etc. And God created man, verse 27, in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And again, the distinction we see in the physical body and the sexes is also a distinction that exists at the soulish level as well. And this explains, well, you know, men and women are not the same. They're not designed to be the same. But yet fully, in order for God to express himself, and in order for God to help the, you know, understand in some ways, he couldn't just have men. He couldn't just have women. And so when I hear people bemoaning the fact, oh, well, all men are idiots, well, maybe they are, but guess what? They're also created in the image of God. And or all women are idiots. You know, the old joke, where would we be without Eve in the garden? Yeah, but it wouldn't be any fun, would it? Obviously not. This is another whole thing, you know, that you know, some men think, well, okay, I'm much happier off being or running around with the men, being with the boys, having fun, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but do you really want to live your whole life that way? I mean, that's God's will for your niche. That's fine. I understand that. God may or may not provide a right man, a right woman. That's his call. That's his will, though. It's his matter. So the idea here is, though, in order to fully express himself, though, we need men and women. And both are equally valuable in that regard. That God, obviously, there's still an authority structure and factor in there. We know all that. That's reiterated before the fall and after. But it doesn't mean that they're not both equally valuable, and I think they are. And then Genesis 2:7 was when he actually did it, when he fulfilled the completion of this as he created the body and then imputed the soul to Adam. And then Eve was constructed, as we know, in some ways differently than Adam was. Adam was made from the dust of the earth. Eve was made from Adam's rib. And this, now, there's a lot of instruction there, too, in that regard as to why God did it that way. 39, nevertheless, Koheleth simply focuses on what one can see. Again, under the sun, all you can see, there seems to be the same breathing provision for live animals that there is for live men. And 40, this is a good example of ignoring certain truths that do not serve to confirm the point that Koheleth is making. Again, one of the things you have to realize or recognize when you're dealing with a person, if they're presenting a certain line of argument, first thing is you should ask yourself, does this take all the facts into consideration? Or is this line of argument presented, carefully crafted to prove one point and one point only? And if it is, okay, that's fine. I just need to know that. I need to think about the nature of the argument, why it's being presented, where it's going, and what conclusions they want me to draw from this argument that they're making. And what conclusions indeed. Well, 41, again, some faulty reasoning, non sequitur, means it does not follow logically, allows Koheleth to assert that since both die, man is in no way superior to the animal kingdom. Now, again, what is the point and purpose of all of this? Wouldn't the reader naturally stop and think, well, wait a second. I mean, wouldn't that be your first thought? Well, wait a second. Sure, we're superior to the animals. Yeah, we do both die. But that's his whole point. Since we both die, we're both transient, man is in no way superior to the animals. He's going to die and pass from the scene. Just like the dog, the cat, the rat, is all going to die and pass from the scene. And what is going to be left after you're gone? Well, the whole argument is that we're like grass, not much. You're going to live your life, you're transient, you prosper for a while, you reach the bloom of youth, I guess, and then you come into your own and you hit the high point of your life, whatever that is. Well, if we die at 70, halfway is 35. Is everybody here over 35? We're all headed down there. It's all downhill from after 35. And the reality is that Once you're dead and gone, what's going to be left of you? You know, if you watch that movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, some shower curtain rings. It's all that's going to be left of me. Well, that's quite a legacy, isn't it? What's going to be left of me? Well, at least I have a website, you know, with my teaching on it till they replace me and then take it all down. Say, well, got a new pastor, we got to take that down. So, what's going to be left? The only thing that'll be left is what happened actually in your lives. That'll be the things that really matter. So 42, this should give the reader pause to consider exactly what he thinks about the nature of mankind as compared with the nature of animals. I think this is designed to get people to stop and think. Okay, I can't argue with him that we both die. I can't argue with him that since we both die, we're not superior. But am I superior in any other way to animals? Oh, well, yeah, sure. I can at least get alone. Animals can't. Lots of ways. Well, 43, and again, I still like being at the top of the food chain. That has some real advantages, I think. So 43, as we will see in the next verse, Koheleth challenges the reader with regard to his own perception about the difference between men and animals. And he's going to introduce this with a challenge. Who knows? Can you prove it to me? And the answer, of course, as Solomon already knows, no, nobody could prove it to him. They couldn't say that. They couldn't prove it experientially that this is the way it is. So therefore, the only way you could know this, again, is by faith. And that has to be the issue. Okay, well, we'll be ready to take that up then on Wednesday. I got 11:56, so that's good enough. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen. Thank you.